Case number 08-5182 et al., United States of America versus Project on Government Oversight Appellant Robert A. Berman. Mr. Nabatoff for Appellant Project Government Oversight, Mr. Berman, Appellant Robert A. Berman, Ms. Rabinowitz, Appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Ross Nabatoff. I represent the Project on Government Oversight. This is a very simple appeal. The question is whether 18 U.S.C. Section 209 is a strict liability statute. The lower court said so and removed from the jury's consideration the essential element of the payor's intent. That is, whether the payor intended to pay Mr. Berman as compensation for his federal work.
Not exactly clear on whether the, and I concede it's not clear, whether the district court really thought that it was imposing strict liability, or rather intent as to one part of the clause and not as to the other part, right? So the district court says that everybody agrees that there was an intent to pay for services. The dispute is whether they had to have an intent as to these particular services.
The dispute is whether the payor intended to compensate the federal employee as compensation for his federal employment services.
Right.
That's right.
But when you say it's strict liability, I want to put this to the government because I'm not clear on what the government's position even is as to the first part. The district court appears to have not even to have said it may be that there has to be subjective intent to compensate for services, but that issue is moot because everybody agrees there was an intent to compensate for services, and that what there is disagreement about is whether it's compensate for services as an employee, and the court said as to the latter that there is no requirement. Have I got that description of the court's holding wrong?
I think you're accurate in terms of the confusion in the district court as to what the district court said, because even his jury instructions were rather confusing. Because he omitted as an essential element of the offense any mens rea at all, and then he added that other instruction that said you can consider subjective intent.
Wait, when you say mens rea, that's to say nothing in particular. What are we talking about? Do you have to have
compensatory intent?
Knowledge? Could the instruction have been the evidence has to show that the defendants had knowledge that the work, the services about which were were services within the employee's official duties?
I believe the proper compensatory intent is the one that was...
I want to know whether you think mine is the proper one.
No, sir, I don't.
Why not?
Because...
You had knowledge that the services for which he was being paid were within his government service...
You have to intend to pay it for his government services.
Well, you already agreed you were paying for government services. That wasn't an issue.
No, we actually didn't agree to that.
For services. For services.
Right.
Okay. So is the question properly that the jury should have considered whether each knew that these services were within the compass of his official government duties?
No. I think the question is whether the district court should have permitted the jury to consider whether Pogo possessed the requisite compensatory intent, the same intent that the lower court, the Fourth Circuit in Crandon.
We have to be really precise here. My understanding is that you believe there should have, not a may, that they should have allowed the jury or permitted the jury. Your position, as I hate to put your position to you, but I thought your position was that there has to be an instruction, that is, in order to find Pogo liable, you must find that it intended to compensate for services as an officer of the United States.
That's it.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
And that was in our proposed jury instructions.
Now, Judge Edwards asks a subtle question, which is intent the same as knowledge? So is it possible, for example, I take it you didn't ask for a jury instruction on that question. All right. But is it possible to have an intent to compensate for services as an employee of the United States without knowing that the services are the ones that the person performs as an employee of the United States? It seems at least in this case these would overlap considerably.
I think that's right.
Okay.
I think one would be subsumed within the other. But at the end of the day, as this court said in 2006, there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether Pogo paid Mr. Berman as compensation for his federal services.
So back on jury instructions. What do you make of Judge Bates' jury instruction about the subjective intent to Pogo? You referred to it before. What did that mean?
From my perspective, yes. It meant absolutely nothing because he told the jury to consider something, but it wasn't an essential element of the offense. So the jury
also consider what services Pogo subjectively intended the payment to be for.
That's correct.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Because they didn't have to, before finding Pogo liable, they did not have to consider that because that was not an essential element of the offense as he instructed the jury on the previous page.
So the meaning of that instruction is that you may take intent into consideration as circumstantial evidence, but that intent is not an element. And your position is that intent has to be an element, not just evidence, correct?
Yes. Pure and simple, that's it. Intent has to be an element of 209, and the only case subsequent to Crandon has ruled that way, the Moore case out of Alexandria. In that case, the person pled guilty. The government sued him, trying to recover the entire $100,000, and the judge did not grant summary judgment for the government, saying the government had to prove the entire $100,000 was paid with compensatory intent. This is not, even though the government says that Judge Bates did not hold that this is a strict liability offense, I don't see how it's not a strict liability offense when mens rea is not an essential element of the offense. That, to me, is the definition of strict liability.
How do you get around the Crandon? I know you say it's dicta, saying that good faith won't excuse a violation of the statute.
Crandon said neither good faith nor full disclosure nor exemplary performance would excuse the making or receipt of a prohibited payment. So the question is, what is a prohibited payment? And a prohibited payment is one that the payor makes intending to compensate the person, the federal employee, for his federal services as compensation.
What would good faith be here other than a situation in which it was not known that the compensation was for government service?
Good faith usually applies in the specific intent crimes area, and that's where I think there's some error. My time is up, but I'm going to finish the question. This is a general intent crime other than the willfulness aspect, which has a five-year penalty, I think, okay? And when you get to general intent, you still have to have that general intent. It's still not, I make the payment to a federal employee, I know he's working for the federal government and he has some services, therefore I'm guilty of 209. That can't be it. There has to be some mens rea. There's no congressional intent to exclude mens rea. And under this circuit's precedent, mens rea is the rule, not the exception.
Go through this again with me, because you're stating a disjunction between what the judge stated as the elements and what he's put in the instruction to the jury, and it's not as clear to me as you seem to think it is. The payment was, this is the fourth element, the payment was his compensation for Mr. Berman's services as an officer of the executive branch. That's an element. You don't disagree with that, right?
I don't disagree with that.
Well, let me finish, okay? So he says that's the element. The payment was as compensation for. And then he says to the jury, you may consider what services Pogo subjectively intended the payment to be for.
My answer to that is that he specifically excluded our proposed jury instructions.
I want to know what's wrong with this, not whether you would have liked yours better. I'm trying to figure out whether the district court erred.
The district court did not inform the jury that before finding Pogo liable for a Section 209 violation, it had to find that Pogo intended to compensate Mr. Berman for his federal work. It is not in the jury instructions, and it was specifically excluded on the...
To put this in the context of a murder case, if the judge had said, in deciding whether or not the defendant committed first-degree murder, you may consider whether he thought about this in advance, that would be error, right?
Right.
He would have to say, You cannot find him guilty of first-degree murder unless you find that he did plan this in advance. That's the distinction, right?
That is the distinction. Thank you. And if there are no further questions.
Mr. Berman?
May it please the court, I'm Robert Berman, acting pro se in this proceeding. I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. 209 is intended as a special case in the general injunction against serving two masters. Of all the ethics statutes, it is the only one about salary payments, not about any payments. It's about salary payments for specific federal duties, not about anything the employee does during the workday. It is like the other ethics statutes in that it is a criminal statute, and therefore the rule of lenity applies to any ambiguity in the ambit of the statute. It does require intent, and Congress did not create a specific civil remedy. These observations are explicitly stated in Crandon, in the OGE memorandum, and in the memorandum and opinion by the Attorney General and the OLC. These statements also run counter to the argument of the government and the rulings of the district court. This case is unique for 209. In more than 90 years since 209 and its predecessors existed, I've not been able to find any case in which a violation of 209 has been asserted by a public service award, particularly a public service award by a nonprofit institution. 209 has never been claimed to be a strict liability statute.
Let me ask you a similar question.
Yes, sir.
I've been raised with the first counsel. If the instruction had been that you, Pogo, knew that the activity for which you were paid was within your government service, is that enough? Is there anything wrong with that? I'm not saying that's what the district court judge did, but if that had been the instruction, the jury finds that they knew that the activity for which he was being given this money was within his government service. Does that do it?
No, sir, I don't believe it does.
Why not?
Because I believe that knowledge of the government duties and knowledge of the job description, et cetera, is one element of it. But beyond that element, there must be an intent to compensate for some portion of that service, not simply knowledge of what the service
is. Knew that the activity for which he was paid was within the government service. Why isn't that the connection? I'm just missing this. I'm not saying the judge did it, but I'm not getting it. Because it sounds like each of you are arguing, unless you can prove that we specifically had bad ideas in mind, and we just win, which means you'd win in every case, because it's almost impossible to show. You're trying to show the wrongdoing here, I think, by showing that, look, you knew, I'm not saying this is what happened, but I'm postulating some things. Knew that the activity for which you were agreeing to take money and for which they were agreeing to give money was services within government service. And isn't that what the statute covers?
I think the best way to respond to that, sir, is through citing Oberhardt, in which there was not only an asserted knowledge of the government service, but that Oberhardt testified that he had a specific intent to compensate Bridges only for what was what his normal government service would be. That specific intent, that expression of his intent, was enough for the court at that point to say, that's it, we don't even have to inquire into what the services were. Your intent was, by your own statement, was to compensate for those services. So I think that's what the distinction is, sir.
We may not be on the same page. Go ahead with your argument.
A common thread in the 209 cases, in the OGE, in the OLC, in the Attorney General's opinions, is that the 209 payers have been in a position to benefit from preferential treatment, and that the employee has been in a position to render some preferential treatment.
Now you're really playing into your opponent's hands. I mean, in Sundiamond and Crandon, the whole point of these cases is that there's a distinction between 209 and 201, and the distinction is whether you get something for it or it's intended for some purpose like that. You can't be saying that supplementation, you can only be found guilty of that if you intend to give them, the other side, something in exchange for the money, or they intend to buy some government favor for the money. That's either bribery or gratuity.
They're talking about two paymasters. Unless there is something that the other party can gain in some way, unless the federal employee, me in this case, is in a position to show favoritism.
So imagine that you're just the world's most altruistic rich person, okay? But you think that some government employees, say judges, don't make enough money. They work really hard, but they don't make enough money. And so they say, well, I'm gonna give all the judges an extra, I don't know, $100 a month on their paycheck every month for doing their government work, because I think the government doesn't pay enough. And I intend to do that, and I know it's for their government work. I don't know whether judges are covered by this section, so I'll leave that aside, assuming that they are. Don't you think that would violate the supplementation statute?
In strictest form, yes, it would violate it, because, as you said there was a specific intent to compensate for those government services.
Right. Even though there's no intention and no expectation that that person could ever get anything in value for that. It's irrelevant whether the giver thinks that he or she is going to get anything.
In that case, that's correct, but that is also, I don't believe, based on the OLC and the OGE opinions, is that that's what 209 was for. 209, I don't think, was for the case of the father, for example, who wants his son to go into public service, and therefore says, I'm going to pay the difference between what you could make on the outside, because I want you to be a good public servant. Strictly speaking, that would be a violation of 209. But that's not the purpose. Strictly speaking, that would not be a violation for 209. I misspoke, because there aren't specific government services identified in that. There is only government service generally. And 209 requires, particularly after Congress revised the statute in 62, 209 requires a direct relationship between specific assigned services and not any related service.
Okay. And Mr. Berman, your time's expired. Thank you very much. I will hear from the government.
May it please the court, my name is Judith Rabinowitz. I represent the United States in this matter. It is obvious from the court's questions that the issue in this case is what precisely are the elements of a 209A offense?
Yeah, and I guess the first question, what precisely is the government's position right. as to the elements of a 209 offense?
We're more interested in the latter.
The government's position is the same as the district court's, that the elements are the offense are that the payment must be for services, and those services must be as a government employee.
So just so I'm clear about that, because I think you were somewhat ambiguous in the brief. It must be not just that the jury, if this weren't a case where the court was deciding that there was no reasonable jury could conclude otherwise, that the jury must decide that there's subjective intent to compensate for services. Is that your position?
I do not think that the government does not think that it is required that the jury get inside the minds of the defendants to determine that the services must be for
So you don't think subjective intent is an element at all, then?
No, I do not think it's an element of the offense. The jury must find that the payment must be for services, but to determine whether the payment is for services, the jury may consider not only subjective facts, but also subjective facts.
I want to know what the element of the offense is. So you're saying this is essentially a strict liability crime, that is, the intent of the doer is irrelevant. The actual intent of the doer is irrelevant in all respects. That's the government's position.
The government thinks that applying the term strict liability can lead to more confusion than enlighten the case. What the government is saying is that the element of the statute requiring that the payment be for services may be found for that determination. The subjective intent of the wrongdoer, of the defendants, may be relevant, but the statute does not require a finding
of subjective intent.
Of subjective intent to make that
determination. Is there any other statute in which intent is defined as an element as objective? That's what you're putting in.
Intent may always be determined by inferred from objective facts.
Of course, it may always be inferred, and that's the standard red book jury instruction, but that's not my question. My question is there any statute under which when the judge gives a jury instruction as the elements, the judge says you must find intent, but the subjective intent is not required? Is there any other statute that follows that mode?
I am unaware of...
Me too. That's why I find this very surprising kind of argument. I mean, I can see if you want to make an argument, I'm not saying it would be a winner, but you could make an argument that no intent is required. But I don't know any statute where, and this is a criminal statute, where intent is objective in this way. And I was just wondering whether you know of any.
No, Your Honor, I don't know of any. To be frank, I haven't thought of it precisely in those terms.
Well, you have to, as first counsel argues, it's a persuasive argument that the district court stated one of the elements is that Pogo intended such supplementation. We're all lawyers, and we see that word. We assume it means something. And as Judge Garland just asked you, is there some statute that we're missing?
Well, actually, the judge doesn't even use the word intended, right?
No.
That's the request of instruction.
The judge just says the payment was as compensation.
Right. Looking at
Let's move on to that question. So the statute says that it must be as compensation for his services. Why isn't that an indication of intent? That is, that Congress... When you talk about compensation, there's some motive behind that. Why isn't that an indication that Congress wants the purpose, the subjective purpose, to be an element?
One could say that the term for suggests an element of intent.
Of subjective intent,
But to go so far as to saying the subjective intent and the motives of the defendant are a required element of the statute goes too far. And that conclusion is compelled by the Supreme Court's decisions in Crandon and in Sundiamond. In Sundiamond in particular, the court stated that 209A criminalizes the giving or the receiving of any supplementation without regard to the purpose.
Yeah, let's pause over Sundiamond for 1 second. So in Sundiamond, they're looking at another statute, right, 201. And that statute also does not, 201C. And that statute also does not use the word intent in it at all. But what it uses are the words for or because of an official act, uses the word for. And the court says that that means intent, right? With respect to that 201C, that there has to be an intent to perform for or because of an official act. So why isn't, again, they are construing a statute that doesn't have an express intent requirement, but because the word for or because of sounds like motivation, that intent is required. And why is that different from as compensation for his services?
To the extent that the court determines that that the term for does suggest a requirement of intent, the district court properly instructed the jury that it had to, before finding a finding of liability, that the jury must determine that the payment was for services.
That's a clever solution, but not a complete solution. If it's an element, you have to say, you have to instruct the jury that intent is an element. You can't sort of get around it by saying all you have to do is use the words for.
That was a good try, though.
Because we're here arguing, you and the other side are arguing, and you and I are discussing whether that really means intent or not, and a jury is not going to be clear, or certainly every juror is not going to be clear. If we think that for means intent, but it's not clear enough for you and I to agree on, it's certainly not clear enough to expect that the jury will understand the word for to mean intent.
Well, the court then went on to explain what it means for a payment to be for, that the jury may consider both objective and subjective factors. I believe the court went on to say whether Pogo believed or whether Mr. Berman understood.
But that wasn't permitted in Sundiamond. It wouldn't have been enough in Sundiamond to say to the jury, in order to find this person guilty of a gratuity, all you have to do is find that it was for or because of an official act, and in doing so, you may consider his intent. You would agree that that would not be a lawful jury instruction, right? Under 201. 201.
I do not recall in Sundiamond. In Sundiamond, the focus appeared to be the link between the thing of value and the act, the for or because of an official act. The focus was on that link. The focus was not specifically on intent, and intent wasn't.
The court approves the respondent's argument that an official has an abundance of relevant matters on his plate should not insulate him or his benefactors from the gratuity statute, as long as the jury is required to find the requisite intent. And then the court says, the distinguishing feature of each crime is its intent element. Bribery requires intent to influence, and illegal gratuity, on the other hand, may merely be a reward. Now, the government's not taking the position that in 201C, intent is not an element, is it? I'm just asking you. That's not the
again,
position
this
of the
is
United
the,
States Attorney's Office in this district. Just had very large en banc case called Valdez on this very subject. And the government did not take the position that gratuity is an intentless crime or an objective intentless crime.
Well, yeah, as the court indicates from its questioning, there are many, many different levels to intent. Judge Edwards brought up specifically the level of knowledge. If the level of knowledge is necessary, you don't also have to say in the instructions that you must prove intent. The level is knowledge.
Yeah, but the instruction was not what I was posing. That is, they knew that the activity for which he was paid. So that's really two things the jury would be considering. Well, was within his government service.
Well, the government would suggest that knowledge is, you know, one level, and four is another level. In the United States v. Nofziger, this court decided that in a statute which was in which there was another conflict of interest statute, by the way, under 18 U.S.C. 207, that the word knowingly, the mens rea intent element knowingly, introduced what the issue was, whether it introduced one or two clauses that followed it. And the court specifically framed the issue as not merely a grammatical issue, but one in which if it were determined that it only introduced the first clause and not the second, that there was, that the defendant could be convicted even if he had the mistaken belief in the second element of that statute.
The court didn't interpret it that way.
The court did not interpret it that way.
As to both.
That's correct.
So let me give you a hypothetical here. So imagine that a person in the criminal division of the Department of Justice, also let's make it the civil appellate section of the Department of Justice, for purposes of his work or her work in the department, produces an appellate advocacy manual. Okay, and then an internal manual, and then shops it to POGO and says, you know, I have this manual which I've been working on completely on my own at night, not as part of my duties. I promise you it has nothing to do with my duties. And POGO says, all right, well, you know, this is great. We need an appellate advocacy manual, and we'll pay you for that appellate advocacy manual as long as you swear that you didn't do it as part of your duties. But it is part of his duties, and you have, you know, a direction from his section or her section chief saying you must do it. Is POGO liable, even though it did not know that the manual was produced as part of the duties of the lawyer?
Cranham very clearly says, Your Honor, I would say it would depend on how. That's a factual question.
They have a videotape. And in the videotape, Mr. Letter says, I don't know, to somebody in POGO, I did this. I'm sorry, Mr. Letter. Somebody else says, a lawyer in civil appellate says, I swear on my mother's head that I did this at night after work. And they have a video in which this is, in which the person says this. So all the facts are clear. There's no dispute about the facts. But it's also no dispute about the facts that Mr. Kopp has ordered Mr. Letter, or whoever it is, to have produced this internal appellate advocacy manual. Those are the facts. Not debatable. Recorded on videotape. It's not just a question of good faith. So you say that the Supreme Court says good faith is not a defense, right? But in criminal law, good faith is not a defense to a willfulness offense. This is the very definition of what good, if you look at the Supreme Court's opinion in Bryan and the Supreme Court's opinion in Cheek, willfulness means that you intend to violate the law, not just that you knew each element of the offense, but that you have a corrupt intent to violate. And here the court says, and quite rightly, that good faith is not a defense because the section that made good faith a defense wasn't passed until a month after the oral argument in Crandon.
Judge Garland, Crandon was a decision that was made in the context of a civil case.
Yeah, but Crandon is the case that uses the words. Is this the one that uses? I'm sorry, maybe I've got it wrong. Is it Sundiamond or Crandon that uses the good reference?
It's Crandon that says that good faith, full disclosure, exemplary public service is not a defense.
Right. But this is also a criminal case. I mean, this is also a criminal statute,
it's,
right?
It is a criminal statute.
And there is no distinction. That is, the elements are the same.
Yes, but if good faith is not a defense, it would not be a defense to a civil statute either.
I understand that. So what I'm saying is that at the time that Crandon came down, Section 216 did not have a willfulness element for the five-year offense, right?
I don't know what the criminal offense, the criminal element was, but 216B was... 216B was enacted after oral argument and before the actual decision was issued.
Right. And it wasn't at issue in Crandon.
It was not at issue in Crandon.
So actually Crandon is wrong from now on with respect to 216B, right?
I would argue that it is not wrong.
So you think that the government's position is that even though 216B now requires willfulness, that good faith is not a defense to a 216B violation. I'm to a 216A2, I'm sorry, 216A2, which came down after the, right, we're talking about 216A2. 216A2 now says, did not say at the time of the offense in Crandon, but now said, whoever willfully engages in the conduct constituting the offense shall be imprisoned for not more than 5 years. That's what it now says. It's not an issue here because the person's not being in prison for 5 years. But is the government's position that good faith is not a defense to 16A2?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. I believe that you know it.
So let me
Sun Diamond was certainly decided afterwards, and even Sun Diamond, granted it's dictum, but even Sun Diamond said that 209 criminalizes that conduct without regard to the purpose.
Yes, but I agree with that, but that is in the context of a discussion of purpose being either quid pro quo under bribery or payment for a specific official act as compared to. So those purposes are not obviously relevant with respect to 209. That's the difference in purpose. You don't have to pay in exchange for something, and you don't have to pay conferring for an official act. That's the context in which the court is explaining the difference between 209 and 201. The court isn't addressing this question of whether there's any intent requirement in 209. Is it? I mean, there's nothing in the language there that indicates that that's what they're doing.
Your Honor, that's not how I read Sun Diamond, nor the other cases that this court and the 11th Circuit have found under the conflict of interest statutes. Those cases clearly say that when there is no intent element, you know, corruptly, knowingly, intent to influence within. Within the conflict of interest statutes, then for the very reason that Congress intended to enact a group of statutes as a prophylactic measure to protect the integrity of government contracting, if we have to get, as Judge Edgewood asked the question earlier, if we have to get into the heads of the defendants, if subjective intent. Intent that the money was paid for a bad purpose, then the government will never be able to prove.
Well, you haven't.
Depending, especially if you use the knowledge approach, and I'm just listening to this, but you infer certain things reasonably if you can show that they had knowledge that this activity. And you can show that that was within his government employment, and you can show that they were intending to pay this money for that service. That stuff, That's not an impossible burden.
But the statute does not speak in terms of knowledge. The statute speaks in terms of
force. We're going around in circles on whether or not it's strict liability, which you don't want us to use, but that's what it becomes, or whether it requires some kind of showing of intent or knowledge.
Once again, the it's the government's position that the court properly instructed the jury that the payment must be for government services and allowed and in fact admitted much evidence on the subjective intent of the defendants.
You switched to harmless error now?
Yes, I.
Oh, you did. Okay.
It is definitely at most harmless error. The court admitted.
Why shouldn't our focus be on the jury instruction, though? The fact that it came in otherwise, that's not relevant. We're talking about an instruction to the jury on whether the district court properly included an element of the offense or not. So.
Well, the government argues that the district court did properly instruct the jury that the payment must be for services and those services must be governmental in nature.
Not in describing the elements of the offense.
Right? And described how the jury should find and that they may look into both subjective and objective facts.
Not in describing the elements of the offense, right?
Pardon?
Not in describing the elements of the offense.
The court specifically said that
when he described the elements of the offense, he did not include that.
He described said how to find those elements of offense. I don't know whether you consider that as describing in the elements of the offense. The court specifically said that in order to find,
it's at 332 of the joint appendix. You're talking about the jury instruction, right?
Yeah, the court said that only those payments that are on unlawful that are made as compensation for an individual's services, and then said that to determine whether services Pogo paid for were for, you may consider both subjective and objective facts, what the parties understood. Furthermore, going to harmless error, not only was this in the instructions, but also the jury instructions included the defendant's theory of the case, in which they argued that the services were whistleblowing services that were apart from the defendant's actual services, the court allowed the defendants to argue in their closing arguments that how could Mr. Berman have paid for services if Pogo didn't even understand that those services were government services. Okay. I see that my
we'll give
my
you a little
time,
more time. I just want to be sure I understand.
Oh, she's done.
I just want to I get to ask you a question. I want to just be clear on in order to define what your argument is. So your position is that if somebody were to pay a government official to produce a book, not knowing that the government had asked the person to produce the book, and could prove that the person didn't know, the person would still be liable, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. However, it seems to me that under the objective facts of a case, it would be pretty difficult. If it is obvious under the objective facts of the case for a jury to determine that book was the employee's government services, then you know, you have, the government has proved its case. And although there may be difficult cases on the fringes, this is not one of those cases.
But that's not usually the way we decide what an element is. So just again, on the example that Pogo gives with respect to the parents, if the parents pay the young Justice Department lawyer a stipend every month because they think that the government salary isn't big enough, if they do that because they want to reward the public service of the government employee, the other side's view is that that is a violation. But if they do it only because they want the employee's lifestyle to be better, it's not. What's your position on that example?
The government's position on that would be that the government must prove that the payment was for a specific service, and that under those circumstances, it would be difficult for the government to prove that there was a specific service that the parents would be rewarding, rather than a subsidy on low income.
So that one may not really raise the problem that the defendants have suggested. Okay. Any other further questions?
There are no further questions. If I might just have a few minutes on the government's appeal of the 216B determination. The 216B is the companion enforcement statute to 209. And that statute states that the court may impose a penalty of not more than $50,000 or the amount of compensation which the person received or offered, whichever is greater. The most natural interpretation of 216B mandates that a penalty in the amount of the wrongful compensation be imposed when that amount exceeds $50,000. This is the only way to give meaningful effect to the phrase, whichever is greater. Otherwise, under Pogo's and the district court's interpretation of the statute, that phrase is rendered superfluous.
So I'm confused about that. I'm not sure what is the more natural reading, but I'm confused about why it's superfluous. So as I understand their reading, it is not more than A, $50,000 for each violation, or B, the amount of compensation, whichever is greater. So if the amount, say there's only one violation as there is here, but the amount of compensation was $100,000, the words whichever is greater play an important role. They mean $100,000, not $50,000.
That is the government's interpretation.
No, but that's Pogo's interpretation as well. It's the not more than part. So it's not more than, that is, the caps are either $50,000 or $100,000, whichever is greater. That's Pogo's position. That's not, Pogo's and Berman's position, not your position, right? Your position is that the first one is not a cap. The first one is a range, and the second one is a cap, right?
Yes.
So just on the question that you started with, which is the words whichever amount is greater, they do play a role in their interpretation.
Your Honor, if you take the example that you're giving me, if you look at that interpretation, whichever amount is greater really is superfluous, because on one side of the equation you have not more than $50,000. On the other side of the equation you have not more than $100,000. So each side is a range, and the larger range will always swallow up the smaller range.
But we would have a completely ambiguous statute if it's on this grammatical theory, not more than $50,000 and not more than $100,000. That would be completely ambiguous because you wouldn't know which of the two caps to apply. So they're telling you, as in most cap statutes, to apply the larger cap. It doesn't strike me that there's no meaning at all to the words, whichever is greater.
It's still, that phrase is still unnecessary because you are always going to end up with the discretion to award or impose a penalty within the larger range. Furthermore, the interpretation of the statute that renders that that mandates the penalty in the amount of the wrongful compensation is the only one that comports with sound public policy. And Crandon tells us that we not only look to the language of the statute, we look to the legislative history, the object and policy of the act. There can be no sound policy reason for allowing a government employee to retain his ill-gotten gains. And Congress sought to preclude this result, one, by making the amount of compensation one measure of the penalty, and two, by requiring that the court impose the greater of the two.
Well, here the court did impose the full amount of the ill-gotten gains, right?
Against the government employee, but against not
against the recipient.
Against the recipient.
What is the public policy of requiring the giver to pay the full amount that he has already given? I understand the other side of the argument. The other side of the argument is to disgorge the wrongful payment. What's the public policy argument that says the giver pays the exact amount that the giver has already given and is not going to get back? So it's really twice. They're paying twice.
Two responses to that, Your Honor. One is that the penalty should be commensurate with the egregiousness of the conduct, and certainly it is more egregious to give a government employee $380,000 than to give him $10. Secondly,
under that theory, if he did $380,000 under the defendant's interpretation, he could be required to pay all the way up to $380,000 or $50,000, and that is more than $10.
Your Honor, once again, though, the larger range swallows up the smaller range, so in essence, we don't even need to resort to the whichever is greater. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, is that when interpreting the statute, one has to look to how it applies to all possible defendants.
But
and if it applies that way to POCO, it's going to apply that way.
You don't trust the judge in his discretion to have the same view as you do about this? I mean, if it's so obvious that Mr. Berman should not be allowed to retain the amount of the wrongful payment, then it should be so obvious to the judge. And in fact, it was so obvious to the judge here and made him make the full repayment. And similarly, if it's obvious to you that the POGO should have to pay some significant amount, why do we think that Congress would have wanted to constrain the court on this in this particular area of the payer rather than just the payee?
Because this is a prophylactic statute intended to protect the integrity of government contracting, and it would not therefore not want to leave it to the discretion of the court to impose a lesser penalty than the amount of wrongful compensation against either party. And if you accept the discretion for one party, you have to accept the discretion for the other party.
I just ask, how does your theory work if the amount of compensation is $40,000? So as I understood, one cap is not more than $50,000, right? And the other cap is the amount of compensation being $40,000, right? Does that mean that the not more than $50,000 is the cap in that circumstance?
The government's view is that the court then has the discretion to impose a penalty of either $40,000 or anywhere between $40,000 and $50,000.
And how do you get that out of the grammar of the statute? If one of the caps is not more than $50,000, how do we get that?
Because on the one side of the scale, you have not more than $50,000. If the court determines that for some reason $30,000 sounds appropriate, You could then compare it to the amount of wrongful compensation, which is $40,000. Therefore, $40,000 is greater than $30,000. Therefore, that's what has to be imposed.
Did you want to wrap?
Your Honors, even assuming the possibility that the district court is correct in its interpretation, the government submits that the court abuses discretion in not permitting the United States to submit further evidence outside the earshot of the jury. It was very clear, both in the jury instructions and under the law, that the amount of the civil penalty is for the court to determine. The court reduced Pogo's penalty on the basis of good faith evidence that was admitted before the jury. The government had every reason not to introduce such evidence because it detracted from its case in chief and could have prejudiced the jury, opened the door to further evidence.
What are you relying on for the proposition the government asked for this hearing?
The government's I forget the precise title of the document, but
response to the Project on Government Oversight's request that the court impose no penalty upon the organization.
Yes,
I don't see an actual express request in there.
Toward the end of that document, the government states that if again, assuming the district court is correct in its decision that it has discretion, that the court should allow the government an opportunity to present evidence, and it proffers certain evidence that the government says it would introduce were it to have this hearing.
After that, was there any when the court didn't have a hearing? Did the government ask for a hearing more expressly than that?
Well, the court just rejected all the government's arguments. There
was no motion for reconsideration.
There was no motion for reconsideration. Okay. In sum, the defendants had a fair trial. The district court issued proper instructions, and the jury made a determination of liability on an abundant record of evidence, including the defendant's subjective intent. Therefore, the government requests that this court affirm the district court's decision on liability and reverse the district court's decision on the amount of the penalty and the construction of the statute of 216B.
Thank you, Mr. Rabinowitz. Mr. Nabatov, how much time does he have left? None. All right, we'll get, no, you don't want any more time? You don't have to take it. Sometimes the best thing to do is to not get back up.
If the court does not have any questions, I will sit down and be quiet.
Okay, you can sit down. Mr. Berman, how about you? That's the cap?
That's the cap.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I was struck by two of the things that the government argued here. First was their position on government services, which seems to have changed between the district court's decision and their response to your question here today. Their position was that payment for services generally is the appropriate measure, not for specific services, specifically payment in connection with government services was the standard that they argued in the district court, and here today they're coming around to the congressional and the OGE and OLC positions that it has to be payment for a specific assigned service. The other thing that I was taken by was the government's position on intent, because it seems to be out of line with what I've seen in government memoranda from the OLC. They identify six items that have to be shown, looked at for intent. Office of Government Ethics, which this court has referenced and referred to and deferred to in the past, in the Airline Pilots Association, specifically identifies the same factors that all have to be evaluated for intent, and all the government opinions before that have shown that same intent. Same out of time, so the court has no other questions.
Thank you. The case will be taken under submission. Let us recess.